Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and once again, we are talking about how recruiting works, this time with Penn head coach Mike Murphy, whose Quakers are getting back to it. Coach Murphy, we just heard you walk through the locker room. We know that September 1st is around the corner. How are you doing? How are you holding up? How was your summer?
I'm doing very well. I'm excited for the start of practice with our team this week, and I'm very much looking forward to September 1st to kind of see where we are with some kids that we watched this summer. And it's always a very interesting dynamic as we get into that first week or two, just to find out, you know, who's interested in what schools. And it's like a massive game of speed dating, where you're just running around and calling kids and trying to figure out which ones are really good fits for us, you know, beyond what we've seen athletically, you know, who are good fits academically and really on the personal side, kids will fit into our locker room, kids that are looking for, you know, academically minded places and things like that.
So to give the audience a little bit of a peek into the pre-production planning meeting, what I just told you is that this is a series. I believe this is the 18th of these that I've recorded between last year and this. The approach that I take relies on two things that I think are why they have elicited a positive response from the audience. The first is my relationship with the counterparty, in this case, you. The second point is I try to structure the conversation around the element of the program that is unique and distinct from the rest of college lacrosse in order to be able to give it a little bit of an anchor. And as I was thinking about Penn, one of the things that I was thinking about is that for all the conversations that you and I have had over the last more than a decade, in my mind, we really haven't spent that much time talking about recruiting. So I'm coming at this with three bullet points, so to speak, but not necessarily as firm of a structure on what I want to get out of the conversation. So point being, hopefully this is going to be a little bit meandering and we can kind of see where it takes us. With that being said, I do like starting with some general topics just to set a baseline for those that have listened to, you know, multiple of these. And the first question I think is a very simple one. Do you enjoy recruiting?
Yes, very much so.
Why?
A lot of reasons. It's, you know, there are kids that come to Penn, you know, it's the start of a relationship that will last, you know, for a very long time, hopefully. And they're, you know, when every kid that we recruit is not going to come to Penn, and I'm still friends with kids at other schools, you know, that didn't come here, you know, even guys from 15, 20 years ago, you know, stay in touch with, you know, guys you coach against. It's just, it's still a fairly small community. And just getting to know different people, you know, and striking up friendships and things, you know, that's a big part of it. And then, you know, the other part is, you know, believing in what I'm offering. You know, I have a lot of confidence that what we're offering kids is in their best interest. And when those things align, what they're looking for is consistent with what we have to offer, then you feel good about the long-term kind of relationship piece. And it's just exciting. You know, you want to bring in a recruiting class that fits in with the other recruiting classes and helps us play lacrosse the way we want to play. And, you know, a lot of that is that I think we have a really good staff, you know, and, you know, those guys do a really good job of identifying talent and things. So the whole thing is, I mean, it's exciting. It's like a little bit of a roller coaster, honestly, because you have days where you like get some good news and days you get bad news, and it's very, very fast paced from one day to the next. It's an exciting time of year for us. Short of, you know, February through May, it's certainly the most exciting and impactful time of the calendar year for us.
What is unique or distinct about recruiting at Penn?
There are probably a couple things, you know, on the surface of it, you know, I think people probably think urban and, business school, you know, so the Wharton thing is pretty unique. Most colleges don't even have a business school, and ours is pretty well established. So I think those things are somewhat unique. You know, we're in a pretty good location just geographically. We're easy to get to from a lot of different kind of hotbeds and things, which which is nice from our standpoint, from a convenience sake. I think we're pretty unique just as a package. It's an Ivy League school, but there's 10,000 students. It's urban, but it doesn't really feel urban when you get onto campus. So I think a lot of parts of it are distinctive and unique. And it's, there's no perfect school out there for 99% of people. So it's really a matter of which school offers most of what you're looking for. So for us, there are certain kids out there for whom this is the best school that they could go to and play lacrosse. And those are the ones we're looking for that are, drawn to what makes us distinctive in terms of, being a higher end lacrosse team and a higher end academic opportunity for them that's located in the city and might have what they want to study.
I want to follow up on the Wharton comment, because that is something that when you talk to families of prospective student athletes or your league rivals, it comes up. And candidly, I know the Wharton School of Business is world renowned and world class, but beyond that, I don't really know what about it. I don't even know what it is. Is it an undergraduate program, or is this guys want to go to Penn so that they can go to Wharton as a grad student? How does it work?
Yeah, it's an undergraduate business school. And so there is an MBA program. They have some other master's programs too. There's a couple graduate programs. And then there's a four-year undergraduate business school, which has been around. It's the oldest one in the country and obviously pretty well respected. And so guys apply directly to the Wharton School of Business. But the nice thing is that even the guys that don't apply directly there, guys that are in the College of Arts and Sciences or the engineering school can still take classes in Wharton. So it's not like it's confined to just those, handful of students. I think they get like 400 a year worldwide are accepted. So even the other Penn students can still take a couple classes there as well. But the guys, we get a couple a year that'll be accepted into the Wharton School and graduate with, I believe it's a master's in science in business.
Got it. So then it's very clear and easily understood why that's so appealing when there's such a strong intersection of guys who want to study business in college relative to guys who want to play lacrosse in college. So that's helpful. In terms of the urban environment and the nature of the location and geography and the size of the school, is it, I guess the question is like percentage breakdown. How often is that a positive versus how often is it a negative or a detriment relative to, what yeah. some of the guys that you might want to pursue, might be looking for something more rural or something smaller?
Right. I mean, hard to really estimate or guesstimate, because once we get to the point where we're on the phone with them and maybe bringing them to campus, they're obviously at least okay with, if not drawn to, an urban environment. And so for the ones who, don't want to even, go down the path of even taking a visit, right? We don't know why that is always, we'll ask occasionally, but it could be, a variety of things if they choose not to. So really kind of hard to say. But because we're located where we are, most people are at least willing to take a look. And generally when they get to campus, they're very pleasantly surprised because they've seen other kind of urban schools, quote unquote. And Penn's different because it's so old. Philadelphia kind of grew around the campus as opposed to the campus being built into the city. And so it's really, kind of picturesque in what you would imagine a college campus looks like. It's about a half mile by a quarter mile rectangle. And once you're in there, it feels like most other college campuses. It just happens to be located in a city. And we're also fortunate because the athletic facilities are all kind of connected and contiguous. And so we don't have to get on a train or get on a bus to go to our, practice fields or anything like that. It's all right there. And there's a fair amount of convenience to it, which I don't think it's a reason to pick Penn, but you can walk, 600 yards from your dorm to our locker room, and then locker room to the field is right there, and the weight room, and then up to their classrooms is only, maybe, a third of a mile walk again. So it's pretty, pretty simple to get around and get to everything from, you know, living arrangements, social opportunities, classroom, and then athletic. It's all right there in a pretty tight-knit space.
So let's flip this around from talking about Penn to talking about lacrosse players. Who are the lacrosse players that can play at Penn that you want to be a part of your program? What does the archetype look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a baseline academically that needs to be met based on the scale in the league and certain requirements at Penn. So there's a good student component to it. And then there's a lacrosse piece, which is kind of the broadest set of criteria, depending on the position and things like that. And then, you know, the third rail is really important to us. It's just the quality of the person and making sure they're a good fit for our locker room. And so we try to be thorough in the way we vet that as well, and just people we talk to and things of that nature. So it sounds pretty simple in terms of like bringing in a good fit academically and athletically as well. But the bar is pretty high in all three areas. So it's not like we've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kids to choose from. You know, we're going up against some other, you know, like-minded schools, and you know, there's probably a pretty small handful of those elite kids in all three areas that a lot of, you know, the bigger programs are kind of fighting over.
When you look at your roster, and particularly in recent years, meaning your freshmen and sophomores that are currently on your team, you've done really well recruiting some of the biggest and most athletic midfielders in the class. Is that a coincidence? Is it a priority? How do you explain it?
Yeah, I mean, people asked me that question in 2019 as well. And, you know, in general, if we can recruit a highly skilled, highly athletic midfielder who is 6'3", that would be better for us than one who's 5'7". But it's not like we don't take guys that are, you know, under 6 feet. You hear about certain schools that have certain kind of prototypes physically. And we really don't. I mean, Leo Hoffman, he certainly doesn't fit that mold, but, you know, we certainly were very, very excited to have him come to Penn. So, you know, we got bigger in, you know, 2019 and 18, 19, 20 with Bartolos and Hanleys of the world and Ben Bedards, but it's not like a hard and fast rule for us that we want to be, you know, over 6'2 in the midfield or have certain types of players at different positions. It's hard enough to bring those three criteria of, you know, good player, good student, and quality person. If you add another element to it, it narrows the funnel a little too high, if that makes sense.
For sure. But with that being said, I'm also interested in the way that you recruit defenders, because not to say that there's a type or a profile, but you guys have been, you know, particularly proficient in bringing in exceptionally talented players who have contributed and been a part of your recent, you know, your team's recent success. How do you describe your approach to recruiting defenders?
Yeah, I mean, I do think part of it is intangible. Obviously, some of it's measurable in terms of size and speed and footwork. You know, it's harder to evaluate defensemen, I believe. So we've certainly, you know, missed out on some and probably made some poor decisions in the evaluation process. But by and large, you know, give Coach Akevis some credit. You know, he's got a good eye for what he's looking for, especially at the defensive end. And we've, you know, thankfully yielded some pretty good guys. And frankly, you know, you look at a Brendan Lavelle, he wasn't super highly recruited coming out of high school, but he's a kid that we just saw something in. And then you know, compare that to a Dante Verdaro or somebody like that who was more highly, you know, was, you know, coming in now as a freshman and somebody that's, you know, likely to play a significant role for us here in time. So, you know, the defensive side of it is a little bit different because, you know, it's pretty easy to see, you know, a 6'3" midfielder that can run by somebody and shoot the ball 100 miles an hour. That kind of stands out. You know, and same thing with an attackman that, you know, can beat his man or just really has good skills. Like, those things are more obvious. And I think on the defensive side, sometimes it's a little harder to really discern, you know, not just what a kid looks like now, but what he projects to look like, you know, in 2 or 3 years.
I want to just follow up with one question there, because whenever I talk about defensemen, I think this is one of the most illustrative ways to find out what a coach values. Oftentimes, the term footwork is a placeholder for something. Guys say, he has good footwork. I don't know that we ever really get into specifically what that means. What does good footwork mean to you?
It means a lot of different things. It is kind of a catch-all phrase. You know, so you could label it athleticism. You can label it, you know, agility, things like that. But it's really, it's part of posture, part of really, you know, neuromuscular, like their ability to chop their feet. It's part of it's the leg strength. You know, you see guys changing directions. You know, if I'm watching a kid in high school, it takes him like 2 or 3 steps. You know, if he puts his left foot in the ground to move from his left to right, and it takes him 2 or 3 false steps before he really starts getting his weight going towards the right, like that's not a good sign. So there's a lot of pieces that go into footwork. And just because you're talented in one of those pieces doesn't necessarily mean that you're good at others. So there are probably subcategories, but it's kind of a good catch-all because we're trying to pick up a lot of things, you know, in terms of size and straight ahead speed and, you know, agility / footwork and stick work and, you know, defensive instincts and things of that nature. So the other thing too is, you know, a lot of these things are improvable, you know, and so if a kid has a decent baseline and, you know, say there's 5 categories, if he's good in 3 or 4 of them, you can improve the 4th or 5th and still develop a very good high school defenseman into hopefully a great college defenseman. If they, you know, at the end of the day, the hardest thing for us all to measure, whether it's NFL, NHL, NBA, you know, college football, us, like you can't measure how badly they want to be great, you know, how much they're going to work on their own, how much, you know, they're internally driven or intrinsically motivated. That's really the biggest challenge to what we do.
And one of the best ways to try to discern that is through your network, specifically guys who have coached the players that you're interested in. How do you incorporate word of mouth and recommendation into your evaluation?
Yeah, I mean, we try to be thorough, and the calendar helps, you know, because we stopped evaluating in July, and you know, and now we're, you know, in August, talking to high school coaches, you know, talking to club coaches, talking to people, you know, that we know and trust in different areas and stuff. Really, the more feedback we can get, the better it is. Really, more from an intangible standpoint, like you're talking about, like, you know, work ethic and desire and, you know, accountability and things like that. So we try to be pretty thorough. I mean, we're not going to make 3 phone calls on, you know, 100 kids, obviously, but, you know, trying to leverage connections that we have and people whose opinions we trust in different areas. We're pretty diligent with that, you know, trying to speak to at least 1 or 2 people on the kids that we're most serious about, just to find out a little bit more about them personally.
You mentioned we, and you previously referred to defensive coordinator Casey Iketa. Mike Abbott is your associate head coach and offensive coordinator. How do you guys distribute responsibility and communicate over the course of June and July when you're gathering evaluations, and then when you come together in August, both when you're trying to balance that, you know, rest and recovery with getting ready for your team to come back to campus with the oncoming approach of September 1st?
Yeah, great question. We're very, very lucky because these guys, they're both really, really good. And so they're very organized, and both of them, you know, so we don't divide the things geographically, really. They just kind of divide up events, and they do certainly a lot more evaluating than I do, in terms of just total man hours. They'll give me lists of guys, like when I'm going to, and I still go to a fair number of events, obviously, but they'll give me guys to look at on different teams and stuff. So they do a lot of the vetting ahead of time. And they just do a really, really good job. They have good eye for talent. You know, we've been together now for, I don't know, 5 or 6, 6, 7 years as a group. And we're just, you know, we're very aligned in how we evaluate what we're looking for, you know, how we approach events and things. And they do a really, really good job of you know, covering a broad, you know, casting a wide net initially. And then, you know, they create a list. We use a Google Doc that we just kind of constantly refine starting in June. And I mean, they really probably started it in November last fall and then refine it, you know, in May, June, July. And then we really sit down in August and look at it and really start to make some adjustments, get a sense of, you know, what kind of kids might be good students for us and things of that nature. And then we feel like we have a pretty good plan, you know, going into September 1, because, you know, Coach Abbott and Coach Aketa have done so much groundwork, you know, over the course of the year to prepare us for that in so many different ways. And, you know, on-field evaluations, phone calls, you know, watching film, and we have tons of conversations just about what we're looking for, you know, this kid versus that kid, you know, and trying to figure out, you know, how we want to position ourselves as we go through September, because September is crazy, like I said before. And, you know, you can see how the NFL draft boards work and what they call them, war rooms and stuff, because right now everything looks great and nobody's committed. Well, I guess a couple of kids are committed to the academies. But by the time you get to September 3rd or 4th, you know, or, you know, say a week into it, there's a bunch of kids off the board and, you know, kids you thought you had a shot at, and everything starts to reshuffle, and you really need to have contingency plans and really kind of a refined list so that you don't make bad decisions under pressure when you get to the middle or end of September and, you know, there's, you know, 8 goalies off the board or 5 faceoff kids or 15 attackmen, whatever the case may be.
One of the things that's really interesting about what you just said is it reminds me of something that Lars Tiffany said last year, which is, you know, in for most of the folks that recruit in September and October, you know, at the highest end of the spectrum, you know, these are programs that are used to winning 60, 70, maybe 80% of their games. The majority of, you know, at the best, you might win 30% of your recruiting battles. More likely, right, it's going to be 20%, 15%. And now all of a sudden, you just have to adjust your expectations and mindset, your approach to handling disappointment. What's that like?
Yep. Yeah, oh, no doubt. It's especially when these kids that we've invested a lot, you know, we've gone to see them in their house or school and, you know, a number of phone calls, just all the hours that we put into watching them play. And, you know, you have a really good relationship with them. You know, they might come to your school, you know, and then they would be really happy to our school, but they would also be really happy and ultimately choose another place. It's crushing, you know. It's just like losing a game. And to me, the feeling in some instances is very similar, but you get over it quickly because you move on to the next kid. You still like the kid. Like, you know, some coaches, I think, you know, get a little bit testy when a kid calls them and tells them they're going somewhere else. Like, I hope I've never done that. I don't think I have, you know, because these are all good kids and, you know, you want to have a good relationship with them. You shake their hand in a game, you know, when you play them and stuff. So you wish them the best and you understand. I mean, there's a lot of good options out there and most of us are going to be somewhere between, you know, 35 or 40% and, you know, maybe 10% in some cases in terms of landing the recruits we're going after. So you just go into it knowing that, you know, all right, you know, there's, you know, we got to get the right kids here and however many kids we have to go and approach to get, you know, 10 good candidates is what we're going to have to do. So you don't go into it thinking you're going to just get the top, those 10 kids that you want.
I want to shift the conversation a little bit. As I mentioned at the top, there's an opportunity here to be a little bit more expansive. And one of the things that's distinct, not necessarily about Penn, but about you, is that for a decade or more, you've been in a leadership position within the IMLCA, the Men's Coaches Association. And the IMLCA has touched recruiting at least 3 ways. I'm sure there are more, but just at the top of my mind are through accrediting events, partner events, getting involved in the proposal that changed the timeline and created this ban on contact prior to September 1st in your junior year. And then more recently, you know, creating the IMLCA tournament around the convention in Florida. I'm kind of setting aside or not even including the partnership with sports recruits and creating IMLCA recruits. So that's a fourth. How do you describe, and we can probably go a little deeper on some of these topics if you're interested, but how do you describe that kind of official capacity relative to the issue, the trend lines, And to the extent that there have been problems, the problems that you guys have, and your individual point of view on it, that you have tried to solve.
Yeah, I mean, people always ask me like why I do this work for the IMLCA, and I feel so fortunate to have the job that I have, to be a Division I coach at a place like Penn. And I feel like I need to give back and leave this sport and this profession better than I found it. And that's obviously why I do it. We don't make any money off of this. Like, it's really a lot of work for not a lot of return on that. But I do feel good about what we've done, and Richie Meads, he created this thing, and he had a couple of visions, and really the mantra is coaches helping coaches. And I feel like we do a good job of that. And I think we've done a really good job here. I think it's, 20 years old now almost. And we've done a lot of good stuff, like the things you mentioned. And I was on the rules committee too, and kind of felt the same way about that obligation. There's not a lot of glory in those positions, but you want to do what's right. I think it's very important, for me, even on the rules committee, to not wear my Penn hat in that room. And the same thing is true of these IMLCA initiatives, that I really think they've been very, very productive. We worked with the IWLCA, I remember talking to Kirsten Kimmel, and I forget who their executive director was at the time, when we put the recruiting legislation in. Like, our sport is better now because of the, sports recruits page, where everybody knows where to put their information, and coaches know where to look for it. The recruiting calendar is better. And these things aren't perfect, and we'll continue to hopefully tweak them and make this whole process better for the families and everybody involved. But, you feel good about it. Like, we're making progress here. And I think hopefully the next thing we can do is address our championship and our Final Four and get more fans in the stands and build up that event. Even, it's gone down a little bit, but it's still the biggest event in our sport. And hopefully we can get some people behind that. And that's probably the next thing that I'll be looking at from the IMLCA perspective, is growing our Final Four and our championships.
Well, that's a topic that I've got thoughts on, but we can save that for another podcast. But I do want to follow up on what you said in terms of the progress that you've made and the incremental improvements that are still available. One of the elements of these conversations that I particularly enjoy is when a coach is in a position to put on his dad hat and think about it from the perspective, I guess, kind of two perspectives. The experience that the child has going through the process, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're kind of starting the process with number three, correct?
Number four. So I saw you last summer with our third child.
Yeah.
And I saw you this summer with our fourth child.
Got it.
So we have two in college, one senior in high school who's committed somewhere, and then our youngest guy is a ninth grader. So he'll go through this stuff in 2 years. But, and we have a kid playing football in college, two lacrosse college players. So feel very, very fortunate to have been on these journeys. And I would tell you that in almost every instance as a coach, at Penn and at the IMLCA, I can never not look at something from the kid's perspective and the family's perspective. It's just, it's kind of the way I'm wired, I guess. And it's, at the end of the day, it's the most important thing. This sport is about the guys, the kids playing it, the guys playing it, the girls playing it. And so you really want to take that into account with every decision that you make, either as a head coach or, somebody working for a coaches association or whatever it might be.
Totally. But at the same time, and this is kind of what I wanted to drill in on, they are different. The experience of and kind of having the best interest of the kid is in some ways different from having the best interest of the parent, primarily because of the way in which, the kid in the healthiest circumstances is the one driving the situation, because he or she is doing what he or she wants to do. So let's start there, and then let's think about it from the standpoint of the parent after. What have you learned by watching your kids go through this that has informed your approach to how you recruit kids to play for Penn?
So much. Yeah, so much. You're a little more empathetic, both in the recruiting process and in the coaching process. you know, you just, you know, having seen my kids go through it, both the recruiting part and the playing part, you know, I think it's rounded out my view. I think I'm a little better equipped to see this, you know, from 360 degrees, and, you know, and you know, people are traumatized, and maybe I'm fortunate because in at least our first three cases, they've all ended in really good fits and places for them. And I do think the process is enjoyable. Now, there is a musical chairs element to it because, you know, I think 3% of high school boys are going to go on and play Division I lacrosse, and 10% will play varsity lacrosse of some sort. But if kids just go into it, and I was talking to just a friend who's got a 2026 child today, it's like, it's enjoyable. Like, you know, all the people we met in all three cases, you know, and, you know, we've had three kids go through it now. It is enjoyable. Like, you meet people and, you know, maybe you don't get an offer from your dream school, but in the end, you might be better off at the other place anyway. And just having an open mind about things, being proactive and, you know, going into things with a good attitude, you know, things will generally work out the right way for almost everybody involved. And, you know, having gone through it, you know, and with three kids now, it really has helped me, I guess, be a little bit more deliberate somewhat and understanding in the way we're approaching, especially the kids, but the families as well.
You touched on directly what I wanted to get your thought on, which is it should be enjoyable, but it shouldn't necessarily be easy. And that's something that I kind of push back on when folks talk about reform within the process in an effort to make it quote unquote easier. And I'm not saying that everybody is advocating for it, but it is a term that I hear every once in a while. And what I kind of default to is, well, most of the things that are worth doing or worth having are difficult. And I'm curious what you saw in terms of your kids' process, the way in which the disappointment helped them develop their own tools for handling adversity.
Oh, I mean, no doubt. And personal, you know, adversity and resilience and athletic and everything else. And that's the beauty of this sport and the beauty of this process. You know, I mean, how many kids are going to get called and offered by every single school in the country? I mean, maybe you can count them on one hand. So at some point, everybody's going to get some sort of disappointment, and you just have to learn how to deal with it. And that's where parents can be really, really helpful, you know. And so many parents want to drive the process and create the list for the kid and, you know, get on the phone or, like, over listen over to the phone call. And, you know, it's just like, you don't need to do that. Like, this is not, you know, it's not a commodity process. And that's, I think, one of the things that's evolved over the last 10 or 20 years, you know, maybe with the proliferation of the club game, because now all of a sudden they're paying to play club lacrosse and they're expecting some return on that. And that return is generally the college opportunity. So it's gone from kind of this passion that kids have, and, you know, when they do have that passion and they love the process and the improvement and things like that, then those are the ones who get the college opportunities. And now I feel like a lot of families go into this like, all right, you know, we're going to invest in lacrosse or hockey or baseball, and we're going to get a scholarship out of it. And as soon as they go in with those expectations, I feel like the whole process is, you know, it's gone from joy to a business. And when that happens, it's not about the kid anymore. It's really about, I mean, it is, but it's really about getting something back for what you've put into the sport. And at that point, you know, it's really not as enjoyable, and it's really not about growing as a kid and, you know, getting to a place where you can, you know, be happy and be, you know, kind of pushed and challenged and things. It's really just about, all right, you know, we're going to put $5,000 a year in the club lacrosse, and, you know, we're going to do all these tournaments and run all over the place. And in return, we're going to get, you know, an opportunity, a diploma from this school or a scholarship from that school. And it's really kind of sad, you know. Hopefully, you know, people start to think about it and just understand that this is about their kid and their kid's experience and their kid's growth. And their kid really needs to drive, you know, all of it. And I also don't feel like 16-year-old kids are capable of doing the entire thing by themselves. Some of them are, but by and large, they need some guidance. And I was certainly there to help guide all three of our kids through the process. Just really in terms of questions, like, what do you prefer? What do you like here? Not necessarily, you know, telling them, you know, what to do, or wasn't listening to their phone calls or part of their Zooms with coaches, and, you know, really just more of a sounding board. And, you know, I would go on visits with them and just so, you know, I could be there for them. But, and that's why I think it was enjoyable. Like, you know, in all three cases, and one of my sons plays football, so it was a different model. But, you know, we visited five places and, you know, went through the whole thing and got to meet some really good people, you know, and places where he didn't go. And, you know, some people I still stay in touch with. So I think if people go into it with the right kind of frame of mind, and letting this be part of the kids' growth and development, and, you know, speaking on the phone to these, you know, coaches, and, you know, learning how to tell a coach, no, thank you, I'm not interested in things, but that's really, really important and part of the evolution of your kids, you know?
100%. And you kind of answered what was going to be my follow-up question, which was, you know, what did you learn as a parent? Not necessarily in terms of what you applied to your job as the Penn men's lacrosse coach, although I'm sure there are a lot of lessons there, but more so in terms of, like, the level of empathy that you have for the parents that are going through the process. And obviously, I would imagine for, you know, the parent of any kid who has an opportunity to visit Penn or, you know, host you for a visit, that's got to be a really exciting opportunity. But at the same time, to the point about musical chairs, you know, when an opportunity for an Ivy League education is kind of on the doorstep, then it feels like the stakes are really high. And so as a result, I can imagine it kind of maximizes the stress. Do you feel that in those interactions?
Yeah, you do, you know, and it depends on the family a little bit. And I certainly make an effort to de-stress that, which comes a lot from timelines and, you know, it's in our case, like, you know, what kind of GPA do they have to have, or what kind of SAT score do they have to have? You try to, like, you know, not soften the, you know, hard edges around those things, but really just make this a relationship, because that's what it is. You know, you're just trying to develop a relationship with these people. You need to provide information, you know, is there an offer or not an offer? And, you know, what if there is an offer, you know, what is the GPA and what is the, you know, curriculum need to look like and test scores and things like that. So there are some mechanical pieces to it that you have to include, but I think just making it a pleasant experience for, even, you know, if a kid that comes that doesn't want to end up at Penn, or a kid that we maybe aren't going to offer in the end, just, you know, at least, you know, making sure they come and have a positive experience when they're on campus, and trying to reduce some of the stress around it. And I understand how lucky I am, you know, having gone through this with three kids, but I kind of knew what it was going to be like, having been on the other side of it. And so I am, you know, I understand how fortunate I am to be in that position. But, you know, I also don't feel like, just the way my wife and I are wired, like, we didn't have our heart set on some, like, you know, big name brand fancy type of place for our kids. It was really about what is the best fit for each of them. And the three of them are different, and our fourth child is different again. And so, like, the right place for them, you know, is going to be the right place for them. They have to kind of figure that out and do a little bit of soul searching and ask them. That's where I think we can be helpful, is asking them questions about, what do you really want? You know, and every kid is a little bit different in terms of their preferences and criteria, and just helping them, I think, establish that. And at the end of the day, you just want them to go to a place where they're going to be happy. And, you know, so far, the two that we have in college, you know, it's a pretty rare day that they aren't really happy where they are. And, you know, that's really all you could ask for.
So in order to end this conversation, I want to shift the focus back a little bit more to Penn and maybe not your approach, but more so how some of the recent circumstances in the world of college athletics have affected your approach to recruiting. And some of these things aren't even applicable to Ivy League schools. So the question is actually really more framed about, you know, how has the landscape addressed or changed? And in some extent, we're not going to know until September 1st or September 2nd. But first, the additional year by virtue of 2020 and 2021, you know, for the Ivy League being canceled, and the way that that changed the roster composition with respect to guys having an additional year of eligibility. And Penn was more fortunate than some with respect to, you know, the ability to try to maximize the remaining years of eligibility. How did that affect your approach to recruiting from a roster management standpoint?
Yeah, frankly, we were pretty fortunate in that the guys that are fifth years now for us, like we have three that are coming back. That recruiting class, which was, I think, the class of 2020, that were freshmen during 21 when the year was canceled, that was a very small class. I think it was, you know, 8 or 9 guys. And so we, by definition, had like, you know, we were short 2 or 3 or 4 players, you know, in that one recruiting class. And so when we had guys coming back from those different classes, we were kind of able to absorb that a little bit, at least partially. So we never really got to, you know, 56, you know, never approached 60 by any stretch. We were usually 51 to 52 or 3, I think, which is a little bigger than normal. But, you know, I think that this will be the last year of that. I think we have low 50s again right now. And so when we no longer have fifth years, it'll come back. So that was, you know, I'd love to say that was some great idea that we had, but it was really just, you know, kind of fortunate because we brought in, you know, I think we had a transfer and then we had, you know, one kid that one spot that we used the year earlier or something. So the fact that we had a high school class of 2020 that was particularly small that kind of came through the program as that was happening was really more of a matter of fortunate circumstances than any sort of kind of roster management brainstorm we had.
The ability to profit off of your name, image, and likeness as a college athlete became legal on July 1st, 2021. And it was one thing for a year, and then it was another thing for a year. And now it's kind of settled into a little bit of a status quo, and it's about to be disrupted, presumably, by the House settlement, which is not what this question is about. We'll save that for the next one. How did NIL affect or change your job? And realizing that the Ivy League has made it very clear that they're not going to play in that space, but now you're recruiting against non-Ivy League programs who can.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say, you know, like we lost a number of recruits last year to different schools that are scholarship and NIL schools. I never asked, you know, if NIL was a factor in that. It's certainly going to impact the landscape of what we're doing, you know, and my guess, and I don't know this, is that, and this whole thing has kind of gone in waves. It's been a crazy, you know, couple of years, really, COVID, you know, into transfer portal and NIL, and now the Power Four and House settlement. It just kind of keeps coming at us. And so, you know, I don't think we really know what this is going to look like, even for another year or two. And, you know, the big time football programs that are paying kids, you know, well into 6 figures and 7 figures, that'll never happen in the sport of lacrosse. It just won't. And so, you know, you hope that, you know, at least in selfishly in our case for Penn and our league, that people will still value the education and you think about, you know, some of the salaries that people make coming out of these schools, going to Wall Street and consulting and Google and these other companies, you know, it really does over a 30 or 40 year career, you know, it makes, you know, well, I don't know what the NIL figures are looking like now, but if you think about that over the course of a 30 or 40 year career, you know, hopefully people just look at it that way instead of, you know, a 1 year or 4 year offer of, you know, what is, you know, probably a fraction of what those salaries are for people that come out of good schools and go and work for, you know, the investment banks of the world and the consulting world. So, yeah, but that's not every family, and a lot of families, you know, are going to be, you know, factoring the finances in pretty considerably with their decisions. And, you know, in those cases, we're probably going to have a harder time getting those kids to come to Penn just for financial aid.
Test optionality and now the end of affirmative action as an admission factor. Did either of those really impact your approach or the outcome of recruiting at Penn?
The test optionality has really been interesting. Initially it was probably helpful, and now it's actually pretty hurtful because the Ivy League has a way that they've calculated the academic index without testing, and it just makes it harder to get respectable numbers on the index scale. It's really, really challenging. You know, without testing, the ceiling is just a lot lower. And so it's a problem, and the Ivy League needs to look at this across all sports, really, because it's hindering our ability to recruit more kids just based on the way that they've decided to calculate the academic index without testing. And so hopefully the pendulum swings back the other way a little bit. It's really pulled those numbers down where, it's required us to have a much higher GPA on average than we would have had to have, two or three years ago.
And then lastly, I kind of brought it up a minute ago, but the House settlement was proposed, or the NCAA released their proposed settlement on July 26th, a Friday, and aided by some prominent voices in lacrosse, the notion for a couple days at least, and I wrote an article trying to disabuse this, and maybe that had something to do with a little bit of a more modest reception of the news, but the immediate reaction was, oh my God, 48 full scholarships, everybody's going to get a scholarship. What was your reaction? Summarized by that laugh.
I'm sure at first I read your article, I'm like, oh my gosh, how are people going to afford this? Like, oh my gosh, like, how are we going to deal with this? And then just started thinking about it, like, there's no way they're going to do that. If you just, you look at, the landscape of what's going on in college athletics in the last 10 or 20 years, clearly football is driving, this ship. And so their limit is 105, and, you can bet that any institution that can afford pretty much anything is going to put all 105 scholarships into that, and I'm sure they'll do the same for basketball and women's basketball. And then after that, I don't know how many sports are going to get to their limit. Now, the roster limit is one thing, but there very few schools are going to get their scholarship level to their roster limit, in my opinion, and certainly for us at 48, like that is a exorbitant amount of money, even for a, maybe a state school that's not as expensive in a big conference where there's a lot of money. It's still like that. Those are all dollars you're spending on our sport that you aren't spending on football. And so it's hard to imagine that they're going to put a lot of that into our sport, but maybe not. Maybe there's a sport at a school where, a lacrosse team at a school where they really value the men's lacrosse and women's lacrosse and they want to invest in that. But it's kind of hard to imagine that the needle's going to move drastically from 12.6.
I agree. It's been interesting in terms of the way some of this has been communicated, and what's most interesting is that this proposal has not been accepted by the judge. Now, I said on a podcast that I now expect it is more likely that it will be. It is also going to be immediately challenged for a variety of reasons and in a variety of ways, such that I think a lot of athletic administrators are talking about, this new status quo is being really short-lived, like 1 to 2 years. And what the subsequent status quo looks like is just as undefined as, what this settlement would have looked like prior to it being proposed. So with all that being said, the world of changing athletics, and particularly the stress of recruiting, you talked about how crazy the month of September is, but how aside from February to May, it is the most rewarding, maybe. I don't know if that was the word you used, but that was what I inferred based on what you were saying. So just to close, the kind of the counterpoint or mirrored question to do you enjoy recruiting is, how much do you enjoy being a college coach at this moment in time relative to early in your career? And as you focus on progress, What are some of the things that you want to see coming down the pipeline relative to recruiting or outside of it that, you know, to use a cliche, be the change you want to see in the world? What change does Coach Mike Murphy and IMLCA leader Mike Murphy want to see imposed or flourish throughout the lacrosse ecosystem?
Yeah, great question, and I guess multiple parts to it. Do I enjoy coaching more now than I did 20, 30 years ago? Yes and no. I think I enjoy the relationships more, for a lot of the reasons we talked about, having gone through it as a parent, just the relationships with the kids on our team and our coaches and alums, and that part of it is richer to me more meaningful. But the breadth of what we do is so much greater, just adding social media to it. And we video practice and we have, iPad reviews and all the NIL and transfer portal stuff to deal with, and just the compliance of it. Like, compliance alone, is tenfold what it was when I started doing this in the early 90s, So it's better and it's worse. I think overall I probably enjoy it more because I have a broader view of what I'm doing and why, maybe. And I think if there was one thing we could fix in our recruiting, it would definitely be the poaching thing. It was a gentleman's world when I started doing this, and, maybe a dozen years ago or at some point, guys just started recruiting committed kids, and I believe it's wrong, not from a competitive standpoint, just from an integrity standpoint. These are young kids that have given their word to a school. And these guys are, circling around and reaching out to them and trying to get them to break their word. And I couldn't be more against it. And unfortunately, a guy that I used to be friends with in this business, I'm not as close with anymore because that's just the way they believe in doing things. And, it's too bad. I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't want my kids to play for somebody that does. But it's pretty widespread in our sport right now, sadly. So I think that if there's any way we could get that toothpaste back in the tube, I think that our sport would be better. And again, the families that are going through this, I think would be having better experiences if they didn't have to fend off these guys that are trying to re-recruit them and get them to break their word to a school, and that doesn't mean when a kid commits to school X, in September or October of their junior year, that's some sort of, lifetime contract. The kid can change his mind and decommit and reopen his process. But I think for coaches to, reach out and call, text, message committed kids is, I think it's sad.
It actually raises a systemic or procedural question that I'm curious about, because I assume you would concede that the likelihood of putting the toothpaste back in the tube from the standpoint of that behavior occurring is pretty limited. But what could affect the circumstance would be shortening the window from when contact is allowed to when a national letter of intent is signed or a deposit is made. Would you be in favor of that? Or do you think that that's effectively outflanking the problem?
No, I think it would address it. You at least have a shorter window. If we just moved the date back a year,
right,
and it was September 1st of senior year, which is, where you're headed with that, I think it would be better. We get another year to evaluate these kids. They have another year of grades and lacrosse and all that. And then we go through this in September, October, and then they sign letters or, put their deposits in on early decision applications. And, I think it would certainly reduce the problem. It would at least, I think make it better. And, I would advocate for that. I haven't been on a soapbox, pushing for it, but I think it would be a step in the right direction and something I would support.
Well, I had a number of conversations this summer about how much lacrosse kids play and how much time you guys spend on the sidelines in June and July. And it left me thinking that the conversations that happen in December, there's going to be some support for changing the calendar. Now, it's very easy to agree that there's a problem that should be fixed. It's very difficult to agree on a solution. So who knows whether or not something is going to come about. But if that's able to be changed, maybe what we just discussed is able to be changed. I don't know.
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, Mike Murphy, we've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. We hope you got to where you were going safely, and we look forward to watching the recruitment of Penn's class of 26ers from high school, which would mean that they would be 30s from college. Yeah. So Penn's class of 2030. Wow, that's
crazy.
The first time I've thought about that.
Yeah. Unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah. We look forward to watching that unfold. Look forward to seeing the Quakers play in the fall. Have you announced your fall scrimmages yet?
Yeah, we're going to scrimmage the Naval Academy in Washington, D.C. on Sunday. I think it's October 20th.
Very good. My birthday.
Beautiful. All right. Nice. Maybe we can do the coin toss.
There you go. Like I said, we really appreciate your time and joining us on the podcast, and can't wait to watch the Quakers take the field in what will be the spring of 2025, which is almost as arresting as talking about recruiting guys that are going to graduate college in 2030. So enjoy it, and we'll talk again soon.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Terry. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it very much.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.